Here now is your host for today's program, Ruth Copeland.
Hi, welcome to the show. In case you're a new listener, a bit of background on me. I'm British, but I've lived in Santa Cruz for over 10 years, and I'm also an American citizen. I have a professional background in the arts, in music, writing and performance, and also psychotherapy and business. And if you're new to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland, in the first hour, we look at all kinds of topics from all kinds of angles, attempting to see if we have more in common than divides us, focusing on debate rather than one-sided conversations. And we keep a balance between the left and the right brain, with the second hour featuring an in-depth interview with a guest from the arts. If you'd like to contact me, you can email ruth@ksco.com. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the show and issues that you might want me to cover. I will also try to monitor that email address during the show in case you feel like giving your opinion via email as the hour unfolds. So that's ruth@ksco.com. You can also follow me on Twitter and message me there. My Twitter name is @RuthCopeland. You're listening on KSCO AM 1080 or maybe also the live stream at ksco.com. I know the show last week we had some people listening in South Africa. So we have listeners around America and the world. So welcome to you all. In the second hour today, just after three, I'll be interviewing Kenny Hill, master classical guitar luthier and president of the internationally esteemed Hill Guitar Company in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Kenny Hill is one of the most accomplished, experienced and versatile classical guitar makers in the world today. He's recognized as a fine maker, player, teacher and innovator. And Kenny began building guitars in the mid-1970s, first in Santa Barbara, California, then later in the Santa Cruz area. In 1978, he was awarded one of the first California Arts Council grants to an individual artist for his work as a guitar builder and guitarist. And during that time, he was also instructor of guitar on the faculty at University of California, Santa Cruz, where he taught for 3 years. As president of Hill Guitar Company, Inc., Kenny continues to develop the Hill guitar line in Santa Cruz, building fine classical guitars used by talented professional artists and passionate amateurs around the world. We'll talk about Kenny's life and work and what inspires him to make world-class guitars. So do stay with us and hear what Santa Cruz local Kenny Hill has to say just after three. And Hill Guitar Company is also taking part in the Art of Guitar exhibit and festival that's going on at the moment in Santa Cruz, in which KSCO is a sponsor of. So we'll also be talking a little bit about that and giving some information. So, what have we got coming up this hour? This week, we're considering, why is sex rated more strictly than violence in American media? What consequences do we fear from sexual content that we don't fear from violent content? Does sex make us more uncomfortable than violence? Is it legitimate to argue that violent content doesn't affect our behavior, but sexual content does? Is rating films a form of censorship? And if so, what do we want to gain from it? Should it be left up to parents to decide if they take young children to PG-13 and R-rated films? Or should the rating be legally enforced as it is in other countries? Join the conversation. Call the studio with your thoughts on 831-479-1080 or email comments to ruth@ksco.com. And last week on the show, we considered, why is violence such a prominent part of entertainment? And that started me thinking about why sex is rated so much more strictly than violence in American media. Or perhaps, more pertinently, why violence is rated so much more laxly than sex is in American media. In an article by Anita Bush entitled Why Harvey Weinstein's Comments on Movie Violence Matter, which was basically talking about how Harvey Weinstein has come out and said that his company is not going to make films that have gratuitous, glamorized violence anymore. Anita Bush quotes an entertainment marketer of 35 years experience as saying, "The insensitivity that the average person has now because of violence is because people have become so used to it. It's an obsession as well as almost an addiction. It's a cheap way of getting an audience, more people shot and more explosions, but it's at the expense of the story. Abject violence has proven successful, and as long as it is, it will be produced because it is profitable. It's the accepted way of life. Rather than asking, is this the right thing to do? The received wisdom in Hollywood is gun violence, especially in video games, has got out of control. However, they also say they have an obligation to their shareholders to make a profit, and violence sells." And so I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, well, assuming this is true and that money rules in Hollywood, why does the axiom sex sells not get the same kind of precedence? If sex sells, why aren't the shareholders being pandered to in the same way as they are with violence, so that we're bombarded with explicit sexual content in the same way we are with explicit violent content? But this really isn't the case. Violence is rated much more laxly than sexual content. So I'm just wondering why this is. And I don't know if any of you out there have any thoughts on this. But if you do, I'd love to hear them. Call the studio on 831-479-1080. And we're actually not really talking about that explicit a sexual content necessarily compared with the level of violence that's allowed. In Kirby Dick's film, This Film Is Not Yet Rated, which is about the Motion Picture Association of America's rating system, Kimberly Pierce, the director of the film Boys Don't Cry, talks about how she was told she would get an NC-17, which is an adult-only rating for her film, because there was a woman in the film shown having too long a climax. It was a very gentle, beautiful scene, just her face, but apparently she was told that it went on too long and that that was offensive, but she was not told why that was offensive. Now, in the same film, there's a scene where someone is shot in the head and their blood splatters all over the wall behind them, but that was considered fine for an R rating. Another example of the way sex and violence are treated is demonstrated by one of the parameters of the PG-13 rating. Now, in PG-13 films, the F word is allowed only once, but only in the context of abusing someone verbally, not if you're referring to sex. So for a PG-13 rating, apparently, it's okay to treat someone offensively and use the F word, but it's not okay to ask someone sexily if they'd like to get physical with you using the F word. It's okay to show someone's head being blown off, but not to see a woman gently experiencing physical pleasure for too long. And historically, an NC-17 rating is much more likely to be given for sexual content than violence. So I'm just wondering what this says about our society and what we feel comfortable with our children seeing, what we think will damage their fragile minds and what won't, and what consequences we fear from sexual content versus violent content. Why is violence rated so much more laxly than violent content? If you have any thoughts, do call the studio on 831-479-1080. And we have a couple of callers on the line. We have Caleb in Santa Cruz and Forrest in Santa Cruz. So I'm going to go to Caleb first because he called first. So hold on, please, Forrest. I'd love to hear what you have to say as well. So welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Caleb.
Yeah. Yes, I mentioned to Rosemary that quite a few months ago I was in the library, and I happened to turn on some pornography. nothing weird, and I was told to leave. But I could turn on any type of violence on the computer, the most ghastly-looking deaths, animal torture, anything like that, and they won't do anything about it. So that's what I wanted to share. What do you think of that?
Well, it's very peculiar. So I'm just wondering, do you have any ideas on what it is that scares people about sexual content as opposed to violence?
Well, they'll say they don't want children to watch it. But young children watch absolute horrible violence on the computer, and that's okay. I think it's a cultural thing.
Yeah.
In Europe, it'd be a lot different in Europe. But it's a cultural thing in this country. So, and
do you think it comes from a religious space?
Sort of, yeah, it does. Americans are generally squeamish about sex, but it's okay to watch people being beheaded, or being stabbed, or being tortured, or being blown up, or anything like that. It's okay to watch. Anyway, that's all I have to say.
Okay, well, I appreciate you calling, Caleb. Thank you very much. We'll give that
You're
some thought.
You're most welcome. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. Well, that is interesting. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. What is it about sexual content and, you know, not necessarily really extreme sexual content either? I mean, the example that I gave of just showing a woman's face just enjoying sexual pleasure for too long in a very gentle, nice way is considered really offensive. And yet seeing somebody's head blown off and spattered over a wall is considered okay in comparison. So it is strange. So if you have thoughts about what this says about our society and the rationale behind it, I'd love to hear them. We're going to go to Forrest now in Santa Cruz. Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland.
Hi, thanks, Ruth. I just wanted to say, I wanted to kind of preface my remark by saying that I think that a desire to see violent imagery is actually a fairly, it's a human thing. It's a peculiarity, I think, that all humans kind of have to some extent. And I think that our desire to look at violent imagery is probably very similar to our desire to look at sexual imagery. And I think that, you know, that's just kind of like an innate human characteristic. And some people, you know, are obviously they're more sensitive to violent imagery than others. But if you look at the movies that we watch, the most popular movies and television shows that we watch are generally ones that involve some form of violence and generally have the best movies seem to have lots of guns in them, which I think is kind of ironic given that Hollywood seems to be so anti-gun. Yet the majority of movies that they produce feature guns all over the place. So I just think that, you know, that there's kind of obviously there's a hypocrisy there. I just always, like you, I've always found it really strange that a network like AMC is not allowed to show something like a woman's nipple.
Right.
Yet at the same time, they can show a guy getting his head chopped off with a ninja sword.
Yeah.
So
it does make you wonder, doesn't it, what that nipple is going to do to, you know, the fabric of our society. I mean, everything's obviously going to completely break down if we see a nipple. But as you say, if we see horrific violence, then that isn't going to have any effect on us.
Right. And like I said, I think that it's natural for most people to want to see both sexual and violent imagery to some extent. However, I think that because that's true, and if we can understand that and accept that about ourselves, I think that we should also kind of start to self-regulate our exposure to those things, or maybe even start to treat violent imagery in the same way that we do treat pornography. So that, you know, we already do, obviously, we have rating systems for TV shows and movies, so that, you know, if there is violence, you know, you're reasonably informed so that you're not taking your kids to see, you know, violent movies with lots of blood and gore. But, you know, perhaps, you know, like the last caller said, he got in trouble for looking at porno at the library.
Right.
Whereas if he was looking at gory pictures, then nobody said a thing. Well, I think that we should probably treat gory, you know, violent pictures in the same way in our societies, that, you know, that those things are, should not be tolerated in public. However, I'm very much against any kind of censorship.
Right.
I don't believe in any kind of censorship at all, actually. However, I think that there are always, there are appropriate places in our society to display certain things.
Yeah.
And the library is where children are. It's not an appropriate place to display any kind of,
yeah,
you know, violent images.
Forrest, I have to go to a commercial break now, but I would like to ask you a bit more about censorship and ratings. Do you think you could hold on over the break?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. We're going to go to commercials now. Keep it here. It's A Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. A number of the world's most admired guitar builders live and work in Santa Cruz. The Santa Cruz County Art of Guitar Exhibit and Festival runs February 1st through March 15th at the R. Blitzer Gallery in Santa Cruz. Now everyone can view the intimate details of these beautiful guitars and enjoy diverse performances too. Visit the website at santacruzluthiers.org. That's Santa Cruz Luthiers, LUTHIERS.org. Brought to you in part by KSCO.
Folks, Michael Olson here at Santa Cruz Electronics, where doing it yourself is going to a whole new level. Just witnessed cutting-edge technology CNC milling machine. John Bowers, what does this machine do?
It whittles away material from whatever it is you're working with and removes everything until you get to the shape of the part that you want.
Just saw John mill out his own wrench from a chunk of material. He put a computer program in, turned the machine on. The machine said, yes, John, here's your wrench. This is a game changer technology.
It certainly is. It actually allows, you and I and other folks to be able to do small-scale manufacturing right out of their garage.
Come down here to Santa Cruz Electronics on Soquel Avenue and get a demonstration, learn how to do it.
It's great fun and can be rewarding, too.
Come and look at it right here at Santa Cruz Electronics.
2808 Soquel Avenue.
It's a CNC milling machine. Dream up a widget in the morning and have it done in the afternoon and put it on eBay at night. Just like that, right, John?
You bet.
There are so many different ways you can get the latest news. Most times, the best way to get news and information is by listening to the radio. This is Bob from C. Crane, and if you need a new radio receiver that gets excellent reception, then you should try the CC Radio 2, designed for good voice rendition and long-range AM. The CC Radio 2 has a twin-coil ferrite AM antenna built in. It also comes with FM, of course, and the weather band with alert. It's perhaps one of the best radios for a crisis because it also has a 2-meter band to keep you informed during a local disaster by listening to the coordination efforts of ham radio operators. So when it's time to get a new radio, please give us a call and ask about the CC Radio 2.
To order the CC Radio 2, give us a call at 800-522-8863. That's 800-522-8863, or visit us online at ccradio.com.
If you've had it up to here with bickering from the left and right, then tune in to the Costa Report, the new voice of the radical center of the country. Every week, host Rebecca Costa asks world experts to tell us how to fix the toughest problems we now face, from an intractable recession to failing education and climate change. The Costa Report doesn't care whether a good idea comes from the left or right, so long as it works. So don't miss Rebecca Costa every Friday at 2 p.m. right here on KSCO. The Costa Report, a program for the rest of us.
This is KSCO, Santa Cruz, Monterey, Salinas.
And violence, sex, and violence, sex.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. And we are talking about today, why is sex rated more strictly than violence in American media? And before the break, we were talking to Forrest in Santa Cruz, and he was talking about how it's natural for us to want to see both sex and violence and be intrigued by that. He's against censorship, but he thinks there's a time and a place for certain things to be aired. So welcome back, Forrest. Thank you for holding. And we also have Rory in Watsonville, so I'll be going to you after Forrest. Rory, please hang on. We'd love to hear your comments. Hi, Forrest. Oops, I need to press this button because he rang back. Forrest, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Thank you. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, no problem. I didn't hear the bong, so I wasn't sure. So I was curious as to what your opinion is on what I said about there being a natural human desire to want to see violent images.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, I think there is a natural human curiosity, and I think there is a sort of draw to things that are outside the norm. And I think, you know, sort of extreme violence and different forms of sex, for instance, fall into that category. And so there perhaps is a natural curiosity. So I think I do agree with that. I think that's a good point, that there is a basic sort of draw to those.
I think so, and I think it actually kind of goes even beyond a curiosity. I think that I wouldn't be surprised, and I'm no expert on this, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were chemicals that were released in a person's brain when they see, you know, like a zombie getting his head chopped off, or, you know, the bad guy, getting shot or whatever, that kind of, you know, releases kind of like a pleasurable endorphin similar to what you would get if you're watching something of a sexual nature. I think that, you know, that there's probably some chemical thing in our brains that makes us kind of crave that to some extent too.
Yeah.
And I think it's different and different. Some people hate and totally abhor. Like my mom is the type of person where if I'm watching something like Walking Dead, you know, which is one of my favorite shows, she doesn't even want to be in the same room.
Yeah, I don't like that show.
Right. And a lot of people don't, and that's fine. But, other people do kind of enjoy, you know, violent video games and all that. So I think it kind of probably has something to do with the way that you're wired.
Yeah.
And perhaps past experience too.
Yeah, I think it's a complex thing. I think we probably can't say that across the board we all get a buzz out of those things, because I don't think that is true. And I think also there is an element of what we choose to expose ourselves to as well. I mean, you know, that's part of evolving, I think, as a human being rather than being an animal, perhaps. But I did want to ask you, sorry, go on. I wanted to ask you about censorship thing, because I do have some other callers, but go ahead.
Oh, okay, go ahead. I was just going to say quickly that I don't think it's like a necessarily a pleasure response. I think it's actually the opposite, where, you know, certain people love scary movies because they enjoy that kind of fear and that the tense feeling that you get when you watch something like that, and then the release, you know, when it's all over.
Yes.
So I think that, you know, it's not necessarily like, you know, a sexual thing where you're getting like a thrill out of, you know, a positive,
yeah,
you know, kind of feeling from it, but it's more of a, you know, it's different. But anyway, go ahead. What were you going to ask me about censorship?
Well, you were saying that you thought you didn't agree with censorship, but you did think that there was a time and a place for certain things to be aired. For instance, a library wasn't a place, you know, where perhaps children walking by want to see pornography or kind of awful animal violence, or, you know, someone being beheaded or whatever. So if you're not for censorship, right, how would you go about controlling what can be seen in public places?
Well, I mean, I think that there are different forms of censorship. I think that, you know, that there's censorship of the media, which will tell media people who, you know, creative people like yourself who produce a radio show, the government tells you, okay, well, there are these seven words that you can't say, and there are certain subjects
right, yeah,
that you can't talk about on the radio. So, you know, when you talk about stuff like this, you have to be very careful, because if you say something like actually refer to a sexual act,
yes,
in too much detail, or, you know, talk about the Duck Dynasty guy liking the mailman too much, you might get in trouble and Billy might come shut off the transmitter. So,
right,
you know, there are certain things that you have to, you know, that you have to be careful of. And that to me, I think that's what I'm against. I'm against government censorship. However, I think at the level of, like, in a library environment or a public environment where there are children and people who did not ask to be. See, it's all about consent. If I want to download a movie, or, you know, go to a movie theater and watch a movie with all kinds of crazy stuff in it that may be horribly offensive to other people. I have that right. But I don't have that right to go to, you know, go out on the street and play that movie or play that song or whatever.
Right.
Where the public's exposed to it. So I think that's the difference.
You know? Okay. I guess the tricky part would be how you distinguish between those, but I do take your point, Forrest. Well, I'm going to say goodbye now because I have two other callers waiting, but I really appreciate all your comments. You brought up some really interesting points, so I hope you might call in again at a different show.
All right, I sure will. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Forrest. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So we're going to go to Rory in Watsonville now. If you just joined us, we're talking today about why is sex rated more strictly than violence in American media? Or perhaps more pertinently, why is violence rated so much more laxly than sex is? And we also have, I'm not sure if it's Liberty or Liberty in Monterey. So I will be coming to you as soon as we've spoken to Rory. Thank you for holding on. So, Rory, welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
You know, it was interesting that your first caller, Caleb, you know, said he got kicked out of the library for watching porno. And, you know, I've got seven daughters, and I thought, man, what a creep. Who the heck is hanging around watching porno on the library computer? Disgusting. He better be kicked out. Or asked to change it. My gosh.
Yeah.
If I saw him, I'd kick his tush right then and there. I'm a taxpayer.
Yeah.
I've got girls, and I'm sorry, that's creepy.
Yeah.
And first of all, I want to start off by saying indecency and obscenity are legally defined terms, and they're not protected by the First Amendment. Okay? And there's case law, books and cases to back up what I just said. I'm not going to go into all the details. Okay, if a DA wants to prosecute somebody on obscenity, he can do it, or she can do it. And to me, gratuitous sex and violence stinks. I don't care what, whom, and where, because it appeals to our fallen, base natures. And these guys that make these movies, and you can go right to the worst porno, they know they're going to hook a few people, and they're going to make millions. And these are the sorriest human beings you've ever saw. If you know anybody's ever been hooked on porno, especially the men, it's disgusting what it does to them. And they allow it. It's their free will, and everybody's got volition. So I just sit back, and I don't even watch this stuff, Ruth.
Yeah.
My kids never watched this stuff growing up. It's like, no. Now, if they want to grow up and be adults, they want to go watch it, fine.
Yeah.
I protected them from this stuff. And if that's censorship, well, God bless it, because I've used it. Because I can't stand their gratuitous violence. I tell my kids, when it comes to a violent movie, I go, how many times do you think I've seen somebody killed in my life, brutally murdered right in front of me? Never.
Yeah.
You know how strong of an impact that makes on you, your psyche? That's not normal. If you have to see it, then you're going to have some major repercussions in your life that you're going to have to deal with. Not even knowing all the details.
Yeah.
But to sit there and watch murder after murder or brutal beating, it's unbelievable. And I'll tell you one thing. Years ago, I watched a movie. I hadn't watched a lot of movies. A couple asked us over. It's probably been over 15 years ago. It was Kirk Douglas Jr. I don't remember the movie. He was chasing some criminal that was being extradited from Japan back to the States, and he went there to pick him up. And the whole movie is the guy got away at the airport and he's chasing him. And there was so much brutality in that movie, and I watched that probably when I was younger, I thought, whatever, I watched it. But twice that night, I dreamt that somebody was trying to come into my house, and I beat him to a pulp with a baseball bat. Okay, two vivid dreams back to back. Okay, don't tell me that this stuff doesn't impact people's psyche. It does. And it's up to the individual parent to protect their children. And it's up to us as communities to set standards. And I don't want anybody sitting in the library watching porno in the middle of the day. What the heck? And I'm glad the librarian called them on it, you know? And
so,
I'm not a prude, Ruth.
No.
But, you know, what do we need to see? Do we need to see the sperm swimming up the fallopian tube? I mean, where does it stop?
Well, I suppose that would be considered scientific, really. But I wanted to ask you...
And I only say that for effect.
Yes, I know.
The point is,
I know.
What appeals to a prurient interest? You go look up the definition of obscenity and indecency. They talk about appealing to a prurient interest.
Right.
It's legally defined. This is not left to, you know, talk shows in the afternoon.
No, no, thank goodness.
No disrespect to you.
No, no, I think that's very good that it is not left to talk shows to decide that. But I wanted to ask you, Rory, you said you would kick that guy's tush for walking pornography. If you walked past and he was watching a video of a beheading, for instance, a live beheading, would you also kick his tush for that?
And then figuratively I would kick
yes,
his
I know,
tush.
I know.
I would make a big deal about it. That shouldn't be watched on
So why do you think that it's not allowed to, you know, to see sexual imagery, but it is allowed to watch violence? I mean, this is the whole point of my show. It's like, why is that distinguishment being made?
Well, you know, you might want to do a whole history of the review of movies, you know, started with movies before television and censorship boards and what they would allow to be seen and whatnot. And why is there a dichotomy or even an even scale, if you want? I don't know. I don't pretend to know Hollywood and the whole system. I just avoid the whole thing. I don't want to give my money to those people. I got better things to do with my time. So
I don't think it's to do with Hollywood. I think it's to do with the culture in America, because it's very different in other countries. It's just America that censors violence less strongly.
Well, if you compare it to the UK and Western Europe, we're probably more strict. But if you went to other countries, they're stricter than we are. They wouldn't allow that stuff. So it kind of, and I think it has to do with our religious upbringing and training in this country. It's largely Judeo-Christian.
Yeah.
And it's not a libertine. We're not France. We'll never be France. I mean, there's pockets of France.
Yeah.
But that's not us, and that's not who we are,
and
that's okay. We actually draw heavily from our English heritage in this regard. You know, we have to find balance. You know, obviously, if you're telling a movie, if there's a movie and there's a love story, there's a discreet way to tell that story without being gratuitous, and I think that's what it comes down to. But at the same time, I think that people vote with their feet. I'm not for quote unquote censorship, like, okay, this movie's banned now. But I am for enforcing indecency and obscenity laws, because those have been there for our protection for a long time. And unfortunately, they're not enforced. And I'll tell you quickly, in San Luis Obispo, I was just wrapping up school down there in the mid-late 80s. And a movie theater chain out of Los Angeles, you can look this up. It was the Pussycat Theaters. I don't know if they're still in existence. They were a big deal back in the day, big porno deal. Well, they bought an old movie theater movie theater in San Luis Obispo that was in the county. It was outside the city, but it was running, you know, Art Nouveau-type movies and old flicks and just, you know, kind of your offbeat movies. Well, they ran that for 2-3 months or half a year, and all of a sudden they flipped it over to XXX porn. Well, the DA in San Luis Obispo said, you're not going to do that. And he shut them down. And everybody was rejoicing in San Luis. They're like, yeah, get rid of that filth.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. It's filth.
Yeah.
So I'll let you go. I'm sure there's other people. I said what I needed to say.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your comments very
much. Thanks
much. Thanks for calling
Bye-bye.
The show. Bye-bye. So we have Liberty, I believe, in Monterey holding on. I have to go to a commercial break now. I hope you will hold on over that, because I would really like to hear the comments that you have on this subject. So we're going to go to a break now. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland.
Ahoy! Come sail into success for 2014 at the Aptos and Capitola Soquel Chambers of Commerce Showcase. Sailing into success on Thursday, February 20th at the Capitola Mall. Book your ticket now and be a part of this amazing cruise into 2014. Join over 100 other mates aboard the USS Chambers. Register now for the most successful networking and promotional opportunity of the year, where you will be showcased to thousands of people who need your goods and services. All are welcome aboard. Presented by the Valley Yellow Pages at KSCO and KOMY. Sponsored by Aptos Life, Santa Cruz Sentinel, Good Times, Capitola Life, Times Publishing, and Register Pajaronian. Call the Aptos or Capitola Soquel Chambers of Commerce for registration information at 688-1467 or 475-6522. That's 688-1467 or 475-6522. Call today. Don't let your business be left on the dock.
If your family car runs out of gas or oil or water, its engine will fail. If your body runs out of essential mineral or vitamin or amino acid nutrients, it will grow weak and you will be left with aches, pains, and diseases. Some say you can get all 90 of the essential nutrients you need from foods you eat. Maybe, but if you eat foods from farmed out soils or foods that have had the life processed out of them, you will deprive your body of some essential nutrients. You can get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs for less than a daily latte with a 90 for Life Healthy Start Pack. It's easy, it's delicious, and they are essential.
Ace is the place to pick up Dr. Joel Wallach's 90 for Life Healthy Start Pack. Swing by Ace Hardware in Freedom, Gilroy, Marina, Salinas, and Watsonville and ask for the 90 for Life. You'll get all the nutrients your body needs to grow strong and stay healthy for less than a daily latte. Remember, Ace is your place for the 90 for Life.
Hi, I'm Pamela Fugit-Hedrick, the host of Money Moves. Cash flows and money moves, but do you find money moving out of your wallet faster than it comes in? Do you wish you had a personal money manager? Do your best Dirty Harry imitation.
You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Go ahead. Make my day.
Pretend that your finger is your gun. Quick draw, aim, point, and straight ahead. Notice that one finger is pointing out, but you have at least three pointing back at you. You're the best person to manage your own money. To get the tools you need for the job, listen to Money Moves Thursday night from 7 to 8 p.m. As your host, I promise that each week, Money Moves will leave you with some tips and tools to help you manage your own money. Thursday nights, 7 p.m. for Money Moves. Remember, that's Thursday nights, 7 p.m. for Money Moves.
You're listening to KSCO, serving Hollister, Seaside, and Redwood Estates.
Hi, welcome back to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. This hour we're talking about why is sex rated more strictly than violence in American media? What consequences do we fear from sexual content versus violent content? Is it legitimate to argue that violent content does not affect our behavior, but sexual content does? We've got a caller from Monterey on the line who's been waiting for a while. I want to make sure I've got your name right. What is your name?
Liberty.
It is Liberty. Okay. There was a T missing on my screen, and I thought Liberty is an unusual name.
Liberty? Yeah. So, I've been listening to you for a while, and I'm glad that I had a few minutes to give you a call this afternoon.
Well, thank you for doing so.
Yeah. I was going to address the issue of violence more than sex.
Okay.
I think the violence and the desire to see violence, of course, today it's not necessarily direct, although one could look at football and various other contact sports, hockey.
Uh-huh.
But in our past, I really think it's in our genes because I'm of Celtic and Anglo-Saxon heritage, and both of those cultures were extremely violent. The Celts were headhunters, and you know where the Burning Man comes from? That's held every year, big artsy thing out in the desert where they construct this big human figure and set it afire. That's from a Celtic religious observance, actually, that they would have once a day. And they would take sacrificial victims and bundle them up inside this this wicker reproduction of a human and set it fire and basically burn people to death inside. And it's kind of hard for us to wrap our heads around it, that different cultures had different attitudes toward extreme violence. But, you know, the priest during the Inquisition that were burning women and others at the stake,
mm-hmm.
they actually weren't doing it out of malice. They actually thought that they were doing the people a favor by driving wickedness out of them with fire, and that these people were going to go to heaven and that they were doing them a favor.
Yes, I think those people would still rather have made the choice for themselves if they wanted to take that route. Yeah.
You would think, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've had a lot of violence up until recent times, and of course there's still pockets of it, but I hear lefties and atheists putting down Christianity for things like, oh, you know, you force the women in Polynesia to put on these dresses and abandon their native costume and everything. You know, Christians have managed to virtually eliminate human sacrifice, slavery. We're still working on slavery, but human sacrifice and just a number of ghastly things that were in common practice until Christians came along and subdued it. So
I don't know that there's anyone who would argue that Christianity hasn't done some good things. I think one can also argue that Christianity has used a lot of violence, which perhaps is strange considering, you know, that the Bible says love thy neighbor as thyself and do not
Absolutely.
Kill, and you know, so that's a bit of a dichotomy. I also wanted to say with what you were saying about violence, it's true that for a long time that's been the predominant way of approaching things, but certainly 5,000 to 7,000 years ago there were quite a few civilizations that existed without fortifications, without weapons, where men and women were more equal, they were more partnership societies. So it's not that humans have never lived on the earth in a non-violent way. It's just in our kind of living memory and history, there has been a lot of violence. But do you have any thoughts, Liberty, on why violence is sort of tolerated so much more in the media than sex, or why we don't rate violence as strongly as we rate sex? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, actually, there's quite a bit of sex that gets by, too. I went to see The Lion, The Wolf of Wall Street the other day, which, by the way, was a movie I was sure that I wouldn't like, that I wound up really enjoying. It's really a good movie. But there's quite a bit of pretty graphic sex in there, so I wouldn't say that Hollywood has done a very good at suppressing it. You know, they do have this this grade scale, and I do find it curious that they would grade violence, I mean any expression of sex and sexual language, they would suppress that more than the violence it gets through that they allow our kids to see. I do find this curious, and I'm not sure why. I don't know why we're afraid of our young people understanding what's going on with sex and sexuality.
I mean, I gave an example earlier of a film that was going to be given an NC-17 rating because it showed a woman's face having a very gentle and a beautiful climax. That was considered offensive, but a scene where a man had his head blown off and it exploded against a wall with all the blood, that was considered fine. So it's just like a woman's face kind of looking like she's enjoying herself for too long is not allowed, and it's just peculiar. I'm just, you know, open to this subject up to see why, you know, what people's thoughts were on why.
I agree totally, and I wish I could shed some light on it, but I'm as puzzled as you are.
Well, I really appreciate your call, Liberty, and
okay.
I hope you might call in again to the show, 2 to 4 on Wednesdays.
Okay.
Take care.
Enjoy listening to you. Bye.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Well, this is an interesting topic. I'm not sure if we're getting quite to the bottom of what this is all about, why violence is tolerated more than sex. But I've got another caller on the line, Ron in Carmel. Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland.
Oh, hi, Ruth.
Hi.
Have you ever heard of a person whose name was Ted Bundy?
Yes. Was he a serial killer, was he?
He was a serial killer, and did you ever read his final interview before they executed him?
No, I did not.
That would give you a clue as to what's going on here relative to, I guess, pornography and the general public. What he basically attested to was it started off as softcore porn and progressed from there. So with certain individuals, you know, if they are attracted to that, they could travel down the same path. And he killed quite a few women. I don't think he killed as many women as the Green River Killer. The Green River Killer killed almost 50 women. But Bundy was up there, and Bundy, if you saw him, he was like a college kid. I mean, it wasn't like he was wild-eyed looking or anything like that. And yet here was what looked like the everyday kid that you'd run into who was actually a mass murderer.
Yeah.
So go to the last interview of Ted Bundy, and I think you'll find a clue. Okay?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's also been cases. I mean, some of the shooters in the school shootings have been found to have engaged in very violent video games. So one could argue, you know, that is the same trajectory for a few people who perhaps are unbalanced. But I don't know if that really, I mean, what I've been talking about with the sex violence thing is, you know, some quite mild, we're not talking about pornography, quite mild things. For instance, on Facebook, there was a case where they were allowing live beheadings to be shown because they said that you know it couldn't be put up for sadistic pleasure, but they wanted people should have the right to comment that they found this offensive. At the same time, they were not allowing women to post photographs of themselves breastfeeding. So this is the kind of dichotomy I'm trying to look at, of like, why is it offensive to see a woman's breast, but it's not considered offensive to see a poor hostage, you know, in the Middle East being beheaded. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, in my college days, when I took art classes, okay, I had Renaissance, Rococo, and Baroque art, and other classes I took as electives. The basic definition you got when you looked at a nude was, is this a nude or is this pornographic? And the judgment there was, if you looked at it, and you found immediately that you saw that the person was naked, then it tended towards pornography. Whereas if you looked at it and it was a piece of art, it wasn't pornography. So it was the way that the person was depicted on the canvas that counted, you know, which way you went. And granted, you know, the same person, you'd have two different people look at the same piece of artwork, and one would say that it's pornographic and the other one would not. But that was the general guideline that they used in college, from what I recall.
I mean, I would imagine that that guideline falls into the more sexual pleasure that was being demonstrated would veer more towards pornography, which kind of begs the question of what is it that we fear about sexual pleasure being depicted that we don't fear about extreme, horrible violence? I mean, it sort of seems like, how is it going to corrupt us to see sexual pleasure, not pornography?
Well, then you go down the Ted Bundy route then on that.
Okay.
And that's that's in a few. Not everybody is going to travel that same path viewing the same picture, okay? But there will be those people like Bundy who did develop with the softcore porn to a point where he mass murdered women.
But what I'm saying to you is, let's take your point. You're saying that we shouldn't have it, say, because there's a few people who might take it to a horrible place. There's also people who have taken violence to a horrible place. So why don't we also censor violence in the same way that we do sexual content?
Well, maybe we're not comparing apples with apples. You get two different crates of fruit over here on this one.
I guess that is true. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. I guess what I'm trying to say is, why are they different crates of fruit? You know, what in our minds makes them different? You know, makes sex so much more scary than violence?
Well, I don't know.
No, I know. I'm not expecting you to.
I've been married for 43 years, you know. That's all I can say, and that's based upon my history and my education.
Yeah, well, you brought up some interesting points, Ron, so thank you for calling.
All right,
bye-bye. We're getting towards the end of the show now. We've got Richard in Pacific Grove, so I'm going to take his call really quickly. I just want to let you know that after the news at 3, we'll be talking to Kenny Hill of the Kenny Hill Guitar Company, classical guitar maker and player. So, Richard in Pacific Grove, welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. You've got about a minute and a half. What would you like to say?
I don't even need that. I just wonder if this is all have something to do with the church, you know. And it seems like pornography has always been, or sex has always been a problem with different facets of the church. Maybe that's why all these silly circumstances align. You know?
I think that is true. It is a kind of puritanical thing, but there's also a lot, you know, in the New Testament that talks against violence and against, you know, you're supposed to love your neighbor, not kill. So one would think if you would be against both, really, you know, but for some reason there's a lot stronger push to suppress sex than there is violence.
Well, I still think, you know, I talked to you before about this. I still think that we like violence. And,
right.
You know, we can try and deny it and stuff like that. But, you know, there's a certain amount of, I mean, look at all our heroes that we grew up with. You know, it's always the guy that took a little gruff and then he finally explodes and he, you know, he beats everybody up or shoots everybody and makes everybody better. You know what I mean? This is what we look forward to.
Yeah.
We deny it a lot, but we like, right? Look at football, look at boxing, and now we've got the takedown sport, tap out, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, those sports are going crazy.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I mean, I would make a distinction between sort of liking violence and then also the kind of archetype of the hero. I think a lot more people, including women, relate to that idea of the hero figure who's able to, you know, control very difficult situations and make everything right and, you know, set everything to rights. So I think that's appealing to a lot of people.
You know, well, one of these days, if you have this discussion again, it's really interesting because while we have a lot of movies about this guy, that this hero, you know, in true life, a guy who stands up for himself in our society right now, gets in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
I think it would be great, you know, because it's, anytime a guy stands up for himself, they say, you should have known better than hit that guy.
I'm going to have to go now, Richard, because we're going to the news. But thank you so much. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland on KSCO AM 1080 Santa Cruz.
Once again, here's your host, Ruth Copland.
Hi, welcome back to the show, and thanks to all of our callers in the first hour. That was an interesting topic and comments that we got this week. Well, I'm pleased to have in the studio now with me Kenny Hill, master classical guitar luthier, player, and president of the internationally esteemed Hill Guitar Company in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And Kenny Hill is one of the most accomplished, experienced, and versatile classical guitar makers in the world today. He's recognized as a fine maker, player, teacher, and innovator. He's worked as an individual luthier or guitar maker in small workshops as well as in large factory settings to bring fine guitars to thousands of players of all levels around the world. And Kenny began building guitars in the mid-1970s, first in Santa Barbara, then later in the Santa Cruz area. In 1978, he was awarded one of the first California Arts Council grants to an individual artist for his work as a guitar builder and guitarist. And during that time, he was also instructor of guitar on the faculty at University of California, Santa Cruz, where he taught for 3 years. As president of Hill Guitar Company, Kenny continues to develop the Hill Guitar line in Santa Cruz, building fine classical guitars used by talented professional artists and passionate amateurs around the world. And Santa Cruz is the location where luthiers make the entire range of signature and performance model guitars. And then in addition, in 2006, Kenny joined in a new partnership in China to set up a workshop and factory from the ground up with the commitment to make lower cost, high quality instruments for players who couldn't afford his domestic instruments. And that business to date has grown to a factory employing over 200 people and producing over 50,000 guitars per year. And this factory and workshop produces the line of New World guitars to Kenny's design specifications and instruction. And as well as being an inspired guitar maker, teacher and player, Kenny has also written extensively for various guitar publications, including Acoustic Guitar, Soundboard and American Luthery. So welcome to the studio, Kenny.
Thank you, Ruth.
Great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks.
And Kenny and Hill Guitar Company are also taking part in the current Santa Cruz County Art of Guitar Exhibit and Festival, and they'll be presenting a luthery demonstration this Friday at the Museum of Art and History from 6 to 9 p.m. And KSCO is a proud sponsor of the Art of Guitar Exhibit and Festival. So do find out some more about that. You can go to Facebook, and it's Santa Cruz County Art of Guitar on Facebook. Find out more about that. And if you fancy going along this Friday, what will they see if they go this Friday, Kenny?
Well, we've never done this before, but we're just taking out with my sons, basically, who are my workers among my workforce. We're going to move part of the shop down to the museum. We're going to put it up and put it up, some workbenches and tools in a pickup truck, and take some instruments down there and do what we're doing, what they're probably doing right now, building guitars. So we're going to do some live, in-your-face guitar building in the art museum. I've never done anything like this before, but I guess it should work out. Should be kind of cool.
Wow, that sounds fascinating, because I would say, well, I'm sure most people have absolutely no idea how a guitar is built. You know, it's something you've never seen. So to have that opportunity is amazing.
Yeah, well, I guess I'd say I'm used to it, but in some ways I still, you know, the guitar parts and the guitars in process to me are still so visually interesting, and texturally, and the smells and the wood carving and bending and all of that stuff is, it's interesting to other people. It's interesting to me.
Yeah.
I still love watching it and doing it.
That's great, because you've been doing it a really long time. So the
long time.
Fact that you still
a lot of different places.
Love it is great. I think everybody hopes to have a job that they love, and not all of us achieve that. So it's wonderful that you have.
Well, I thought that was important from the beginning.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So you really went for that.
Yeah, I just didn't really see any choice.
You know? Right. I was wondering, you know, what were your first experiences of art? Because, I mean, obviously building guitars is a art form and music, both. I was just interested when you first came
music,
across.
Yeah. I mean, I really started out making music when I was a kid. And I never thought of it exactly as art, even though, you know, I mean, studying music and from all ages, from many centuries and things, I guess that's what it is. It's just a pursuit of an interest, you know.
Right.
Being sort of fascinated by something that's beautiful or surprising or, you know, inscrutable. Intriguing.
Right, yeah. So how old were you, would you say, when you first started playing or being interested in guitars?
Maybe 13 or something, 13, 14. There was a guy, you know, that was sort of in my church who was playing guitar, and he was so cool. He was such a you know, he was a really cool guy, and he was playing guitar, and I thought, that looks cool.
Yes, yeah.
And then, you know, I started playing, and I didn't really take it up seriously until I was in my 20s. I mean, I played, kind of fooled around with it, but about age 25, I got more serious about it.
Right. And what you play mainly classical, is that right?
Or yeah, that's what, you know, that's what I've studied and all. Although my repertoire has sort of morphed away from the kind of warhorse style of classical, and it just, you know, anything that appeals to me. I mean, I'm not playing nearly as much now as I used to.
Right, you're too busy making guitars, are you?
Yeah, and there's just not a lot of demand. I mean, you know, right. There's that. There's not a lot of demand for it, so it sort of takes the motivation out of practicing and things. And yet still, like, I'm playing on Friday night at the museum, and I've had to do a little wood shedding to get some chops back together, but it feels good, you know.
Yeah.
It's nice to play. It's pretty. It's
yeah,
beautiful.
Yeah. And what attracted you to playing classical guitars instead of, say, rock guitar or something like that?
Well, before I was playing guitar, I was playing pipe organ. So I was really attracted to the music of Bach.
Ah, okay, interesting. Yeah.
In mid-high school, maybe, I just sort of got an earful of it from a teacher, from a high school teacher, of the music of Bach. And I don't know, it just struck me, you know. I listened to a lot of other things.
Mm.
But as far as what I wanted to pursue, that's what I chose to pursue. And this was on the pipe organ, which is ridiculous. It's a crazy sort of mad scientist fantasy.
Yeah.
And that was cool. I liked the mad scientist fantasy well enough. But in the long run, there were two things. One is pipe organs are so big that they really limit your mobility. And that mobility is limited to churches. And so I got pretty sick of churches after a while.
Right.
And so there was one day when I really, it was one day. When I was, I guess, 24, 25, I said, I've had it. What can I play Bach? How can I play Bach and hit the road?
Yes, you know? Yeah.
And go somewhere.
Right.
And that was like, well, how about the guitar? How about classical guitar?
Yeah.
So I just went and I started studying some Bach. I had a book and I started, you know, just crunching through Bach on a friend's classical guitar. And picked it up fairly quickly on a modest level anyway.
Yeah.
And then a little bit later, I discovered actually I needed to really kind of learn to play.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Not just crunch through things.
Right.
And that took, I'd say, 10 years or something, you know.
It's a dedication,
like,
isn't it?
Playing to 4 hours a day.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. And for the uninitiated amongst us about guitars, what would be the difference between a classical acoustic guitar and I don't know if you were playing more sort of folk or rock or something like that.
Yeah, acoustic guitar. Well, the biggest difference is a classical guitar will have nylon strings. So that's sort of part of the definition of it. And an acoustic guitar has a box but has steel strings. Now, you know, that's sort of very basic. But as a maker, the biggest difference then is that with the nylon strings, it has about half the tension of the strings as on an acoustic guitar. So you have sort of a different set of goals or necessities. And I've only made a couple of steel string guitars. It's just really not my thing. But they have to be built much more for strength.
That's interesting.
Because of the tension on it. And an nylon string, you can sort of dance on thinner ice, I guess is what it is. And so I feel like I'm building something more like a kite that has, you know, a much more airiness to it and much livelier in a lot of ways because it's not under the stress of the higher tension strings.
And that would show itself in the strength of the neck of the guitar and also
well,
the body?
Or? Yeah, certainly the neck, but also the top. I mean, the soundboard itself.
Oh,
that's
okay.
What makes the sound, you know. So, yeah, the neck has got the playability in it. And if it's, you know, it's under stress and eventually it'll bend, but and there's remedies for that, but and a nylon string guitar will bend too, but it's more about how the top moves that's sort of interesting, you know.
Now that's interesting because I would have thought that the kind of bottom of the guitar was more what's resonating, but it's not. It's the top part.
I gotta say it's everything, but yeah, the top drives it. It's just like a microphone or something that it's or a speaker. You know, if you look at it that way, that it's moving. What resonates is air.
Right.
That's what sound is.
Yeah.
Is sort of movement of air molecules, and that's intimidating. Because every little thing that you do in the guitar when you're making it, that's all you're doing is finding new ways to move the air around the instrument. So the top is a diaphragm. You could look at it that way, that's moving. The body is maybe sort of supports it like a speaker cabinet or something. But
yeah.
It's subtler than all of that because the instrument will be affected by, you know, every little thing. So it's the total of it that makes it appealing or not appealing, you know.
Right, yeah. So there's kind of an art and science to it. It sounds like, you know, when you make something, there's a kind of mystery of what the final thing is going to really sound like.
I guess, you know, if you have the right recipe, which, you know, is a particular model, I think of it kind of like that. And you make the recipe over and over again, you'll get so that you get consistency out of it, even though each instrument will be very distinct. You just can't make the same instrument twice.
Right.
But, you know, it's the art and science. I mean, I see people trying to approach it as science, and most of it, I think, most of the, quote, scientifically built or designed instruments that I've seen fail on the artistic side, really conspicuously fail. And that's sort of a rude judgment to make. But so I've learned to just sort of, I don't know, blurt things out. Changes in the instrument are rarely calculated.
Right.
For me.
Yes.
You just say, I think I'll try it. Yeah, try that. See if it works.
Or maybe it
gives you a clue that if you keep trying, you might get, you know, work something out. And that's my form of innovation. Not exactly planning, you know.
Right. Yeah. A more intuitive process, right. Would you say?
Or yeah, sure.
Kind of. Yeah. Sure. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to Kenny Hill, master classical guitar maker, player, and president of the internationally esteemed Hill Guitar Company in the Santa Cruz Mountains. So do join us after this commercial break. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland and my guest of this hour, Kenny Hill, master classical guitar maker player and president of Hill Guitar Company in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And I wanted to also let you know that Kenny and Hill Guitar Company are taking part in the current Santa Cruz Art of Guitar Exhibit and Festival, which KSCO is a proud sponsor of. And this Friday, Hill Guitar Company will be presenting a luthery, which is guitar making, demonstration at the Museum of Art and History from 6 to 9 p.m. And there will also be some performances, but you will actually get to see how guitars are made, the process. So that sounds really interesting to me. You can go to Facebook to Santa Cruz County Art of Guitar. That's the page for the Art of Guitar Festival. And also, if you go to hillguitar.com, you can check out more information about Kenny Hill and all the guitars that they make. And that's Hill Guitar, singular, not guitars, hillguitar.com. So, Kenny, you said ultimately there are two kinds of guitars in the world, the ones that you really want to play and the ones that you neglect. I want to make ones that people want to play. That's all I really want out of it. I was wondering where that motivation came from and when that started. Has that always been with you? Or?
Well, it became that simple probably later, you know.
Right.
Before it seemed like it was much more mysterious than that. But, I mean, who wouldn't want to? It's the same thing about a radio program. You want to do a radio program somebody wants to listen to, not somebody wants to change the station. It's the same thing.
Right.
But, you know, I am the most clear customer for my guitars. I'm the most clear audience. So it's when I'm playing it and what I want out of the guitar is the basic criteria. And hopefully the market agrees with me, because this is after all, a business ultimately, too.
Right, yeah.
And so then I can sell them, and it means I can stay alive and feed my family and keep doing it. And that's, but, you know, it really is something. It's just about the appeal. You want something to be sort of seductive. And
yeah.
That's what I hope to bring to the guitars that I make, either myself or through other people.
Yeah. When did you first start making guitars sort of as work?
Well,
and how did that come about?
Yeah, I started fixing guitars as work and in my 20s, you know.
Yeah.
And that's how I got around the guitar. That's how I became around it. And it was a funny situation. It's just I was didn't have a job, and a friend of mine had a guitar shop, and his guitar repairman walked out on him.
Yeah.
So he said, "You could do this." And I said, "Well, I'll try it," you know. And that started me as repairs. And then as I was playing the guitar, then, I mean, it just seemed sort of natural to make one. It's,
yeah.
And in some ways it was, I mean, it's a little bit like a cook growing his own food or something, you know, that you feel like you know it a little better. And so as a player, I thought, well, I'll understand the instrument better from the inside and the outside, and the whole experience will be a thing, you know?
Yeah.
And then I realized, well, it is a commodity. You can make one and sell it, and then make another one and sell that.
Yeah.
And so in my 20s is when I started doing that. It didn't really work out for me as a honest-to-God, make-a-living, growing business until the 90s, really.
Right.
And at that point, I decided, well, I mean, it's kind of like I realized it was a business, and I better start treating it like one instead of just sort of, I don't know, just sort of stumbling through it, you know?
Yeah. So do you think most people come into making guitars through a sort of apprenticeship or a self-taught process?
It's pretty hard to find apprenticeship.
In this
town, there's a few guitar companies, including mine and Santa Cruz Guitar and Renaissance Guitar, that are actually sort of, you know, employers.
Right.
And so a lot of guitar makers will come through that. Now, a lot of people that go into those companies think of it as like, oh, this is cool. You know, it's like joining a band or something.
Yeah.
But once you get in it, it's work, you know.
Yes.
It actually is a job, and, you know, you got to do it. And then so some people will come out of those companies. But otherwise, people just, I don't know how other people learn to do it.
Yeah.
I just kind of self-taught myself. I mean, or I've stolen a lot of ideas from other people. But
inspired by others, let's say.
Tribute. It's a tribute.
So I guess when I was thinking about this and interviewing you, I just had never really thought about this before, but presumably all guitars have to be handmade, even if they're not very good. Is that correct? I mean, if they're like a low standard, or is there actually a machine, like production line that can make guitars?
No, you know, I mean, like, in China, where I work sometimes,
right?
It's you know, we're making 150 guitars a day.
But are they being assembled by people?
Yes.
Yes, it's not a robot-type thing.
No, I mean, you know, it's when you get onto that scale, maybe the parts, somebody's doing really repetitive work to make parts.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, somebody's doing repetitive work to pull it together, to assemble it. Somebody's doing things really repetitively, and yet the operations are still just the same.
Yes, yeah.
So there's not some sort of thing that pops them out like a biscuit or something, you know.
No.
It's still got to be all pulled together.
Yeah, that appealed to me when I thought about it, because I don't know, handmade things just are so beautiful. And that brings me to my next question, which is, what is the difference between like a top of the line handmade guitar and one that's made more in the process that you were just talking about? I mean, what would be done differently, and what would the end product, how would it be different? Because I know that's what you really specialize in, is these really wonderful
guitars. Specialize in the whole spectrum now.
Okay.
And that's the funny thing, is that I can make a $500 guitar, or I can make a $10,000 guitar. And, you know, part of it, the difference is the materials, you know, certain attention to detail, and certainly when it comes to just the cost factor, where it's made, you know, what the
labor costs,
cost and the cost of living is, wherever it is. And, but sometimes I wonder, You know, why isn't an $800 guitar as good as an $8,000 guitar? Mm. And I don't exact. I mean, I can. You can say, it well, is. This has yeah. that wood. This has that bracing. Some things are simpler, or you know.
Yeah.
But maybe there's not that big a difference.
I'm not sure if you should be saying that. Really. I mean, some of the difference could be perhaps the inlay work and things like that. Well, the beauty yeah. of the beauty yeah. of the guitar.
The decoration of it is just it, that is a matter of time. So how much time
That's
do you
craftsmanship,
put into it?
Isn't it?
It's, and yeah. and so you get paid for that time. Maybe that increases costs. But I don't like to just increase decoration to increase cost. That's sort of that's not my interest.
No.
You know, I mean, the top of the line instrument sounds fabulous, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't have a kind of separate set of standards while working and lower cost things. I still got the same standards.
Right.
And sometimes it's a sort of a problem, you know, because if you make the cheap guitars turn out really good.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
And of course, that's pretty good. That's a yeah. good thing.
I mean, I suppose there's, you know, some people like to support American-made things, which is part of the difference in cost, isn't it? With you know, people are being paid a living wage in our society rather than somewhere else. And I think also it's the difference between, you know, just having a Formica table and a really beautiful sort of mahogany, you know, antique with inlay and all of that. I mean, there's an aesthetic quality to objects that people get a lot of enjoyment from, isn't there, of just the beauty of something that's also practical.
And that's one of the things that, like, this gallery show has been sort of, you know, pointing at, that there's a physical sort of artistic beauty in it. But ultimately, I feel that, you know, I think of the instrument as a tool.
Right.
And like a car is a tool, like, I don't know, furniture, a little bit less so. But there's, you know, there's pride of ownership too.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, I go through all of that stuff of the labor, you know, where it's from, how, you know, how much a living wage is in China, how much a living wage is here.
Yes.
And I run two shops in California as well as, you know, a big factory in China. And so I see really a spectrum of all
yes.
of that stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people will just say, I don't want anything from China. You know, okay.
Yes.
That's cool. But, yeah. you know, be prepared to spend about 10 times the money then, you know. So are you prepared?
Yes.
you know, I've got a guitar made here, you know, 5 miles from here. No problem. But it's going to cost you $7,000-$8,000, you know.
Yes.
I'm happy. If you want to buy that, I'm happy for that. But
yeah.
I can also provide something for, you know, $500, $1,000, $1,500 that's made someplace else. So kind of there's a lot of needs.
Yeah.
A spectrum of need in the commodity side of this.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're meeting that spectrum of needs with what you're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I would imagine that, you know, when somebody becomes known for making guitars, then there's an allure to having a guitar that's been made by that person. You know, you to own something, you're like, oh, you know, Kenny Hill made this or whatever. You know,
yeah,
it's kind of cool.
There's a little bit of a, you know, fan club side to it.
Yeah.
Sometimes. And there'll be the artist role model side to it. If you've got somebody that you really like.
Yeah.
An artist, a guitarist.
Yes.
Who's playing my guitar. And they really admire that one, and they think, well, he likes it. And they'll try, you know, some fan of that artist will try to get one of my instruments.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that sort of artist endorsement is one of the, is part of the field, you know, getting that sort of recognition.
Yes. Yeah, and you have, I saw on your website, you have a lot of artists who use your guitars.
We've got some great players. But, you know, in the big picture, when you get a really famous artist to play, it's flattering. It makes you, you know, feel good and like you've done something. But really, what's more important to me is seeing them go into the hands kind of developing players.
Mm,
I mean,
yeah.
I really like to see it when good, you know, ambitious students, college students or whatever, you know, conservatory students get their hands on them, because then the guitar becomes a part of their development.
Right.
Famous guy, he's already famous, you know, he's already kind of set in his ways maybe or something. And that's cool. But it's, like I say, it's flattering, but it's more interesting to get the guitars into the hands of evolving players.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And I think you alluded to this earlier, but I wanted to ask you, if you've actually made the guitar yourself, does it affect your experience of playing it?
Yes, of course, but I've been doing it for so long, I hardly ever play anybody else's guitars.
Right.
I pick them and I think, what's wrong with this thing? <You know? laughs> Even really famous, expensive guitars, most of them seem like, well, close, but not good enough.
Okay, so what's the difference then? What don't you like about it? It's just the sound, the feel?
The feel, and, most often.
You know,
I mean, it can be...
String action.
Yeah, all of that.
Yeah.
It's possible. I'm just so accustomed to mine. And now I've gotten so I don't even want to try anybody else's guitars. Because either it's going to be an unpleasant experience, or what if it's better than mine? Then what do I do?
Well, you know, continuous growth in life.
There
you know,
go. Yeah,
that aspiration of
growth through frustration. Yes.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm guessing it's a very personal thing then as a guitar player. I mean, I learned to play guitar when I was, I think, 12, classical guitar, but I ended up not keeping up with it. But I imagine as a guitar player, it, you know, how you feel about the instrument and the sound and everything, it's very personal to you. Is it?
Sure.
The empathy that you feel. So
yeah, yeah.
You're trying to create something that more people feel an empathy with, and you seem to have done that.
Yeah, well, I like them, you know, so then I'm saying, well, maybe somebody else will like it too.
Yes. And understand, when you were working as a writer for Acoustic Guitar Magazine, you made a trip in 1995 to Paracho, Mexico.
Paracho, Mexico, Michoacán.
To cover a masterclass given by José Román Níos, mm-hmm. For the guitar makers of Paracho, and that was what inspired you to create your new venture. Can you, you know, which was the New World guitar line, is that right?
Yeah, come to think of it. Seems like it's so long ago. But yeah, it was funny. I did, I heard that Román Níos, who's sort of an icon, you know, in the field of guitar making.
Right.
Was doing this masterclass down there, and I thought, oh, I'd like to meet him, you know, and I hadn't been to Mexico in a long time. And so it's funny, I called Acoustic Guitar Magazine and said, you know, can I write an article about this? I'm going to, if I go down there and I write it, and they said, well, you could write it.
And we might publish it.
And we might publish it if we like it, you know, and I said, okay. And they said, but don't go down there telling everybody, you know, you're a writer for Acoustic Guitar Magazine.
Oh, right.
So I went down there and told everybody I was a writer for Acoustic Guitar Magazine.
Go out on
and them. Got the foot in the door to a lot of stuff, you know, because of that. And then I came back and they did publish it. And then I made friends with the magazine and the, you know, the publisher's a good friend of mine now. And this, so I've written it various times.
Yeah. But you were inspired by the guitar making and wanting to create a product that was more affordable for more people to use. Is that right?
Yes. And I looked at Paracho. I mean, you can't believe it. It's too dangerous to go down there now, is what they tell me. But you know, there was all these guitar makers. There's a town full of guitar makers, but they're still basically using 19th century technology to do it practically.
Yeah, right.
You know? Doing everything by hand and such a high level of skill. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
But it's so remote and removed and out of the, and didn't have access to a lot of things, information, materials, market, you know, and stuff. So it did seem exciting. And it was a huge learning experience for me to go into that environment and learn from those guys, from being around those really incredible craftsmen. And so, yeah, I sort of started organizing it into, you know, more commercial thing. But I learned a lot from it. Now, I learned a lot of things not to do in the long run, too.
I
eventually closed it because, as much as because of the remoteness, but the climate just was terrible for it. Really awful.
Right. But is that an inspiration that led to your Chinese venture?
It wasn't exactly like from one to the other.
I see, right.
I was frustrated with what, you know, with the problems, with the chronic problems. And so I was having to decide, well, you know, am I going to keep battling this or not?
Yeah.
And then somebody recruited me.
Oh.
Into China. And so it wasn't exactly like I decided, oh, I'm going to go from Mexico to China, but I was qualified to go to China by having done this crazy thing in Mexico.
Right, yeah.
So I was qualified and crazy enough to go into China. Now, 15 years ago, that was a lot crazier than it would be today.
Yeah.
I did it, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
I had to think about it
before
doing it, but I did it.
I'm sure. Yeah, it was almost kind of like the frontier, Western frontier, isn't it? In America, it's kind of like a whole new...
There's a lot, and it's evolved so much. It's unbelievable. But I feel privileged to have been sort of boots on the ground while that's going on, see it with my own experience. You know?
Yeah. Oh, it's inspiring. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to Kenny Hill, master guitar maker, player, and president of Hill Guitar Company. And we're going to be talking to him more after the commercial break. And also, he's going to play for us. So that's going to be beautiful. He's brought one of, I assume, your own guitars with you. So do stay with us through the commercial break. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland on KSCO AM 1080 Santa Cruz. Hi, welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. And this hour, my guest is Kenny Hill, master classical guitar luthier, player, and president of the Hill Guitar Company in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And KSCO is a proud sponsor of the Santa Cruz Art of Guitar Exhibit and Festival, which is currently ongoing. And if you want to know more about that, you can go to Facebook, Santa Cruz County Art of Guitar. And I also wanted to direct you to Kenny's website, hillguitar.com. Well, Hill Guitar Company's website, where you can also find out about Kenny and all his beautiful guitars. So hillguitar.com. And also to let you know that Kenny and Hill Guitar Company are taking part in the current Santa Cruz County of Art Festival. And this Friday, they will be presenting a luthery demonstration at the Museum of Art and History from 6 to 9 p.m. They will actually be demonstrating how guitars are made. And it's the first time that's ever been done by them. So that sounds very interesting. And there'll also be performances. So, Kenny, you've got a beautiful guitar here with you, obviously one of your own.
Yep.
You were saying in the break that it has all the little things that you like best on it. Can you tell us what any of those are, or is it like secret information?
Well, it's not secret information. It probably is not good radio.
Okay, all right. Then.
But,
okay.
There's a number of design innovations that sort of depart from traditional guitar making. It's built with a double top. It's got sound ports. It's got a strange little armrest on it.
Oh, yeah, I see that. Yeah,
and,
it's unusual.
And so these are either acoustic reasons or for ergonomic reasons that are some of it.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, it still sounds like a guitar. You know?
Excellent. So, well, we're going to hear what it sounds like now. You're going to play for us. Thank you.
Should I just point this microphone down?
I would point it just slightly down. Yeah, and I'll monitor the level over here.
Let's see if that works. I mean, you tell me if it's working.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
I'm going to take the headphones off. This
is okay, go for it.
A little distracting.
Just setting up here. This is Kenny Hill playing for us live. That was wonderful. That was really beautiful. What was that?
That's actually a piece by a friend of mine by the name of James Klein. It's called okay. Morning Coffee.
Oh, that would be really nice to listen to with your morning coffee or tea.
A wake up.
Yeah. Oh, that was really beautiful. And while you were playing it, it made me think about, you know, how the guitar is made. And what do you make first? What's the first thing that gets put together?
Kind of the soundboard. I mean, you piece parts together, but the soundboard, which is where the strings are
the front
tied
of it. Yeah. Yeah,
it's a, you know, kind of goes from there. The neck goes on, the sides go on. In the way that I do it, the back goes on, the fingerboard, frets, finish, bridge, strings.
Yeah, and what kind of wood is that guitar made from?
This particular one is Indian rosewood. The back and sides, Spanish cedar neck, ebony fingerboard, and a cedar top. Although this top is fairly complicated. It's a double top. It's a kind of a sandwich that's made up with both spruce and cedar. So that's where it really departs from traditional guitar construction.
Yeah. And you're based in the Santa Cruz Mountains. How did that come about? Are you a local or?
I'm a local, yeah.
You are, okay.
So yeah, I was born in San Jose and, you know, so, you know, I eventually settled over here, got out of what the evil Santa Clara Valley from my when I was a kid, you know, and into the good old bohemian Santa Cruz County. So I was a refugee from there, but yeah. You know, it's a great place to live. It's a great place to be from.
Right.
So that even though I've traveled all over the world, it's like, sure glad to be home, you know.
Yeah. And is there somewhat of a guitar center here?
Yes. I mean, that's why where this festival comes from. It's sort of like Jamie Kelly Curtis said in her vision, you know, realized that, you know, there's just so many guitar makers for the square footage, you know, or square mileage of the geography of this place. And of course, part of it just comes actually, I think, just from the sort of counterculture roots of, you know, I won't say Santa Cruz, but, you know,
the West Coast, so
you know, it's a lot of people that get into guitar making are like me. They're just sort of unemployable, you know.
That's very harsh.
You get into something because you can't hold a job, you know.
Or you found your true talent in life.
Yeah, that's there you go.
Well, I mean, it's not like anyone. Like, I couldn't think, oh God, I'm unemployable. I'm going to start making guitars. I mean, you've obviously got to have some kind of aspiration and ability, haven't you? And vision and
yeah. And I thought, well, this is a good way to avoid getting a job. It's worked out, but it's a little bit like being a surfer and then deciding to make surfboards too. I mean, how's that for an employment demographic? You know.
Yes. Yeah, I get what you're saying.
And so it's great, you know. But there's so many talents now. Some of the talent has spun off from, you know, sort of early people that were here, Santa Cruz Guitar Company.
Yeah.
You know, some of the builders that are featured in this probably came out of that. Also, some are just attracted to the area for all the right reasons, because it's a great place to live.
Yeah.
And other, you know, just sort of strange coincidence, you know. But yeah. We influence each other. It was interesting. We had the opening reception at the Blitzer Gallery the other night, and it was amazing who showed up and how many people showed up for the opening reception of this whole festival. And realized, you know, this was Jamie Kelly Curtis's idea, the whole festival.
Mm.
But it's really, you know, sort of struck a beautiful chord. And we saw that at the reception. It's like, wow, look at all these people and all these people we care about and haven't seen in a long time. So there's this kind of class reunion feel about it, but it involves the whole community.
Yeah.
So there's something that's kind of, I don't know, it's a distillment of some of the attitudes towards community in the guitar making, you know, sort of culture here, that it's inspiring and we're here for the same reason. And you could probably do the same thing with a dance community, with even Santa Cruz filmmaking, whatever, you know. theater because, you know...
There's a very strong arts community in this area,
yeah,
aren't there?
We're really lucky that way.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
And a nice resonance. But, of course, as guitar makers, we don't... I mean, nobody here makes a living off of Santa Cruz County. That just...
Right.
You
yeah.
know, I mean, if 1% of your customer base is here, I'd be surprised.
Really?
So
wow.
It's, you know,
yeah.
as builders,
yes,
there's
yeah.
just so many guitars you can sell in this region, you know,
yeah.
so it has to become national / international to
yes.
really work. Fortunately,
yeah.
you know, in this era, that's not that hard to do.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Back it used to be a lot harder.
Yeah, back in the day, I was going to say, to get known. I mean, it's much easier to reach out now, isn't it, all
yeah.
around the world with the internet and everything.
Yeah, pretty remarkable.
Yeah. So just to let listeners know again, the festival that we're talking about, which KSCO is a proud sponsor of, is the Santa Cruz Art of Guitar Exhibit and Festival. And if you do an internet search of that, it'll come up. But you can also go to Facebook. Santa Cruz County Art of Guitar is the page on Facebook. And also the Hill Guitar Company website is hillguitar.com. And this Friday, the Hill Guitar Company and Kenny will be there as well, playing and demonstrating how guitars are made, 6 to 9 at the Museum of Art and History. And I'm definitely going to go along to that and check
good,
that out.
Good.
It's something I've... very interested to see, something I would never seen before. So
well, that night there's a whole lineup of guitarists too that are playing short sets. I mean, they're really crammed together, but it's featuring most of the guitar exhibitors in this festival will be featured on stage as well. So, you know, there'll be music going on. I don't know what else. There's going to be a bunch of stuff going on there.
Yeah.
And in the course of the next 5 weeks also, there's going to be at least two concerts, because I have artists featured in them, one on March 1st and one on March 6th, and those will happening at the Blitzer Gallery, which is where the gallery show is set up.
Mm.
And if you've never been out, it's out in the Wrigley Building, or whatever it's called now, but it's really interesting out there.
And where is that?
That's out on the west end of town on whatever it's called,
Swift,
Mission Street. Yeah, it's
Swift
it's
Street.
Near there.
Yeah.
It's closer to Western, but
okay.
It's maybe it's called the... University Business Park or something, but they've taken that huge building and subdivided it into all these little gallery and workspaces and
I've seen that. Yes,
it's worth exploring.
Yeah. That sounds very interesting. I also just when I was thinking about basing yourself here, is there anything about the climate here that's good for making guitars or not necessarily?
It's pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's mild. The humidity is not too extreme. I mean, you get into either extreme wet or extreme dry, and you've got problems.
Yeah.
And so we can control it here, manage it pretty well. But humidity is an important component of guitar technology.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's been very interesting talking to you. I've learned a lot of things that I never even knew I wanted to know before until I got into researching you. Well, I mean, you know, I think we're all around guitars and, you know, they're sort of fairly ubiquitous. That you know, even if you can learn three chords, you can enjoy playing a guitar. You know, there's something very engaging about that. And also the knowledge that they've been used for so long. I think stringed instruments, there's that heritage, is something almost not primal, that's a bit early, but the history is appealing, I think.
You know, the thing that I just feel really grateful for and fortunate about is that, you know, here in this, whatever this sort of self-made career, is that it takes you out into the woods. You know, you're cutting wood, you get that good, dirty, smelly, good stuff going. You get all this design, you get all this music, you get the artist relations, and in the context of business, get to travel all over the world and, you know, be a part of essentially the evolution of commerce in the world, you know, and how things are changing, you know, some for better, some for worse. But to be in the midst of it all is really, I just feel really grateful for that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing all of that with us. It's Kenny Hill of the Kenny Hill Guitar Company, and you've been listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. I hope you'll join me next week for the show from 2 till 4 p.m. on Wednesday for our first hour of debate and our second hour of a guest from the arts. And next week we have comedian and Gail Rich Award winner Richard Stockton. So do listen in next week. You're listening on KSCO AM 1080 Santa Cruz and KOMY 1340 Watsonville.